This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Gary Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Chuck Hughes is proud of his city and its history, and especially when it comes to its newest big business, the Hard Rock Northern Indiana Casino. He can connect it all back to the first ideas of bringing gaming to the city. Hughes is the sole surviving Gary Common Council member who was in office back then. And we sat down with him to get his reaction to the new casino opening and of all the history connected to it. First to the casinos along the lake, and now to the Hard Rock Casino, Northern Indiana.
It was a spectacular opening because in Gary particularly, let's say, we're looking for those kinds of opportunities and those mm-hmm. kinds of investments. $300 million with all of the fanfare and the bells and the whistles. It was much anticipated, and Hard Rock being the brand that it is, certainly they brought in celebrities, and they had just a gala event. So it was fantastic on that part. Mm-hmm. Now, relative to the historical part of it, I just really wanted to share with people, since I do have the firsthand knowledge mm-hmm. of how it all came about. As a member of the Gary City Council, we were at a council meeting. And one of my colleagues, who just recently passed last year, the late Roy Pratt, mm-hmm. he had visited Tunica, Mississippi, where they had riverboats. We had not pretty much even heard of riverboats per se. He had visited Tunica, they had riverboats, and he came back all excited, saying that they've got riverboats there, they're generating revenue, they're building around that. Here in Gary, we are in need of resources and revenue, and that's just be a great idea for us to do. And so that was the nexus of the casino idea. Mm-hmm. Now, following logical, obvious procedure, the mayor at the time was presented the proposal, Thomas Barnes. Yeah. Mayor Barnes liked the idea, so he incorporated MacArthur Drake, who's still a local attorney here, who was the corporation counsel at the time. MacArthur Drake drew up the casino legislation, and then it was forwarded to the city council for our approval. And so in the approval process, of course, it passed unanimously. Now, being local elected officials, we did not have the ability to present it to the state because the state controls the gaming license.
Right.
And well, there weren't even licenses at that time. Just the notion of having gambling in the state of Indiana, where it was non-existent to that point. And so we engaged our legislators, which is part of the process of forwarding along. At the time, it was State Representative Earlene Rogers, who we had advanced it to the House, and it was State Senator Carolyn Mosby, who has part of Broadway named after her, has a citizens building named after her in Gary, and so we realized how illustrious she was as well. And so Carolyn Mosby advanced it to the Senate. Now, having said that, it was a very difficult proposition because, as you know, Indiana is a conservative state, and conservative values were such that they were not embracing gambling at that point. And so our legislators did have to do some work, but being a tremendous minority in the legislature, it had to have had Republican legislators determine that this is a way that we could go. And so ultimately, when the state realized how much revenue it could garner as a result, they had a Senate committee that came together, a caucus, and they decided, yeah, let's go with it. And so with that being the process, that's how it started. Unfortunately, or fortunately, well, Gary was afforded the opportunity, but it was Gary's initiative, Gary's idea. My thought is that no one was going to let Gary have that cash cow alone and receive all of that revenue itself. So cities adjacent to Gary that had no idea of casino gambling, never petitioned for it or anything, they were afforded a license as well. And so sort of to pay restitution to Gary, we were granted two licenses. That's how it became the Barden boat and a Trump boat.
Right.
That's
right.
Another story about the Trump boat.
Well, we know about that.
It wasn't. We didn't select Donald Trump. I don't know if you know that.
Well, I know that was he was here lobbying in his way for, and I know that. Yeah, they said that's another story.
We didn't select him. Yes. He then went downstate, and the state legislators overruled our choices, and so that's how. Yeah. Donald Trump got a vote.
Now, what was the reaction when it was still a matter before the Gary City Council to bring up the idea of gambling? Of course, you were doing all these other things and working with then Representative Rogers and with Senator Mosley all the time on the state level. But what was the thoughts back here in Gary about looking for a casino and in turn lobbying, I guess, talking with people about the economic benefits that would come if the boat happened to be here?
It was not an easy process. Mm-hmm. If you look at the city of Gary, we almost have a church on every corner. We probably have more churches than most communities. Uh-huh. And so it was not widely accepted. By law, we had to have a referendum. The citizens had to determine as well whether or not they wanted gaming to come to their community. And the referendum, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it may have been like 55, 45 or something. But it was passed. And to your point, we had to stress the economic benefits, jobs, revenue to the community, additional building around the casino, all of those things to let people know that this was not our idea of just going out to pursue gambling, but to pursue an economic development tool that would help us get out of our financial doldrums.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that people, of course, have noted lately about the fact that the members of the Jackson family, a couple of them came back for the grand opening at the casino in Gary. And of course, the Jackson family has come back before. In fact, there was a big push, I understand, back in the late 90s by the Jackson family to actually do something much more expansive than just being part of the casino. Tell us a little bit about that and about how you feel about now seeing the signs that will be going up along roadsides reminding folks that this is the home of the Jackson Five.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is it was great to see the new Hard Rock Casino develop, see it open, see all the enthusiasm, see the hope that it's given to a lot of people in Gary, the fact that it may help us to have a rebirth of the Black Oak community. So there are some benefits that one cannot deny. But again, when I go back to my history and hearken back to what could have been, then there is a bit of melancholy in that I think the Jacksons have been unfairly maligned for years. There are people who felt as though when they were on top of the world, when there was no scandals, nothing derogatory with their family, that they were riding high, didn't care about Gary, Indiana, and it was only after, let's say, Michael passing or some other things that now they're interested, now they're back. And I'm here to say from a personal perspective that that is just so far from the truth. They have been unfairly maligned as a family. And I think if people really knew the story of them and their thoughts and sentiments about their hometown, there would be a whole different perspective of what folks thought about the Jacksons. And I say that to say this. It was in 1995. I was a young member of the Gary City Council. I'm sure it was in my first term. And Thomas Barnes was the mayor at the time. My secretary at the council office, I happened to be in the office, said that the mayor would like to holler at you. I said, well, great. So I go down the hall. I talk to Mayor Barnes. He's all smiles. He says, Chuck, I got some great news. I said, well, what is that? He said, I got a call from the Jackson family. I said, the Jackson family? Yeah. He said, they called and said they want to come back to their hometown and do something spectacular. I said, Mayor, that is fabulous. That's what we need right now. Mm-hmm. And so once he began to tell me what it was about, he said, we've talked to some of them. They're all in accord. They want to do something major. He said, I want to send some people out there to meet with them to finalize things or whatever. I said, well, that's a good idea, Mayor. He said, I want you to be one of them. I said, well, great. And I didn't question why, but I was happy that he thought I was a person who could be a good emissary for the city to go and meet with them. We met 2 days in their house in Encino. We didn't meet in a convention center or a hotel meeting room or whatever. We were greeted, picked up at the airport by folks representing the attorney, Brian Oxman, that was his name at the time, for the Jacksons. We were taken to the house. We had 2 days of serious, they weren't that serious, just 2 days of meetings to familiarize ourselves with each other and pretty much salivate over what was going to transpire. And what was going to transpire was this. First of all, let me say this too.
Okay.
There was a meeting, an agreement, shall I say, of every Jackson member. In fact, we had signatures of every, who were able to sign, every Jackson member. Except Michael. And the only reason why we didn't have Michael is that Michael pretty much orchestrated, commissioned the meeting. Michael Jackson wasn't going to sit at the table with us. You guys work it out and bring it to me and let's roll with it. So it was probably as much Michael as the entire family. And so we sat around and first people were skeptical about who we would meet with. And this is what I shared with Jerry. I mean, a picture's worth 1,000 words.
Right.
They were saying, oh, they're going out there. Nothing's really going to happen. They're not meeting with any Keith Jackson members or whatever. And so the people we met with was Joe Jackson, Catherine Jackson, Jermaine Jackson, and Janet Jackson. I think that's a pretty good representation.
I would say so, yeah. He's the only person missing. It was Michael. But he's behind the scenes. He's helping, really, basically, as you mentioned, organizing things pretty much.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it probably wouldn't have been a meeting if he wasn't in agreement to do what was going to be done. And so after we sat around and talked about what was going to transpire, Mr. Jackson asked the attorney, Brian Oxman. He said, Brian, what do you think? He said, Mr. J, he called him Mr. J, I think it's a marvelous idea. He says, I'm not promoting it. I just made a call or two, and my phone now is ringing off the hook. Mm-hmm. We're getting calls from all over the world. They started naming people that they knew from China, Dubai, and other places. And I'm just sitting there like trying to be calm in that kind of high-level meeting. And then they asked us for how we felt. My thoughts, and I can kind of paraphrase, was I said, Mr. Jackson, I just think this is wonderful. I said, you guys have conquered the music world. I say, for you all to think enough of Gary to want to come back and do something of this magnitude, I say, it takes your family full circle. I think it thinks volumes of you guys, and I'm happy. And so we were all hugging and singing Kumbaya, ready to bring. And if you want me to describe the project, I certainly will.
Yeah. As it turned out, of course, unfortunately, the project didn't materialize like everybody had hoped. But do you think that now, in 2021, with the fact that the new casino has opened up and we have such a presence of the Jackson 5 in the new casino, that it doesn't completely make up for the fact that the big project never happened, but they still have a very important presence in the casino and in Gary?
Well, there's no doubt about that. Now, if you want me to have as a frame of reference of what could have been and what is, I can do that as well. Here's what it would have been.
Okay.
There would have been a Jackson family. The cost of this project was estimated between $2 and $5 billion. Mm-hmm. That's just the fundamental parts of it, between $2 to $5 billion. It was going to cost the Jacksons exactly nothing. It was going to cost the city of Gary exactly nothing. Investors were going to handle everything. The Jacksons were going to get a huge proportion of the revenue. The city of Gary was going to get the next major chunk. And then we established a foundation of 2% to give to Boys and Girls Clubs and homeless people, whatever the case might be. Now, the project itself would have been a family museum. We had negotiated to where the entire house in its natural state at 2300 Jackson Street would have been one wing of the museum, uplifted, put in the museum. People could go in and see where Michael and five of his siblings slept or whatever the case might be. The other part was going to be, we are the steel city. There was going to be a steel museum.
Right.
And I want you to visualize all of this at the intersection of I-65 and 94. just a bit east of where the casino is now. The next phase of it was going to be a theme park along the lines of a Great America. This was before Michael bought Neverland and all of that. And the fourth phase was going to be a performing arts center. So just imagine the Jackson 5 in their prime, Michael Jackson in his prime, Janet Jackson in her prime, Stevie Wonder and all these people coming in, and what that would have looked like and what it would look like now in 2021.
Right.
So you asked me about the Hard Rock. I am delighted to see it because what was out there before was nothing. Now, why the initial project didn't take place, I'm not going to call any names. It's clearly documented. But the city of Gary rejected it,
yeah.
Said it was not a good idea, was not in Gary's priorities. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. It was just the same. We've got another stretch of a Jackson 5 family history now in place, represented, I guess, by the exhibits, the displays that are set up at the casino. And so it is bringing the Jackson family back to Gary. It's just not the same way it would have been had the big project down the road literally would have been, I suppose.
I am so happy to see that the Jacksons are getting their due and that the city is getting its due in the whole Northwest Indiana by having the ability to see the history and the memorabilia of the Jacksons. And so, yeah, rather than that still remaining a barren area out there, Hard Rock and the Jacksons' contribution and people who have worked to bring that here, they deserve a lot of credit. And so, yeah, I'm glad to see it happen.
Well, Chuck Hughes, thank you for the history lesson and your observations on everything that's happened here recently with the establishment and opening of the Hard Rock Casino, with the Jackson family, their contribution to not only the casino, but what could have been more in the city of Gary. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, but we still have them here, and they're still considering Gary their hometown, and we're glad that they're back in some way. That's all we can hope for, I suppose.
I agree. Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Chuck Hughes for the history lessons today, his thoughts as well about the opening of the Hard Rock Casino. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, today's graduating seniors have survived a year like no other, and they'll also have some great toilet paper stories to tell the grandkids when they retire. But what will their retirement look like, for that matter? And that's one of the big decisions that young adults have to make these days, looking to the future. And for that, let's find out more from Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, fill us in on what young adults are looking into as far as security in their retirement years, as they are now just getting into adulthood.
Well, you know, it's a unique time, right? You're leaving the world of non-responsibility, suppose, so to speak, and going into adulthood, where there's a lot more responsibilities and the freedom of not being tied down at this point to a mortgage or other financial responsibilities. You know, it just doesn't create a lot of focus. You know, and as you go through, unfortunately, you know, high school, college, they don't really provide, I think, the basic financial education. You know, really around how to save, how to invest, how to grow money for your future. And I think the first thing that's just, you know, critical to do is, you know, develop and establish financial goals along with your career and life goals.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a recent graduate, you know, all these things like buying a home, getting married, having children, you know, those are all big things that you have to think about, but you haven't really given any thought to yet.
Oh, that's right. It's way off in the future, retirement especially. You know, it's at least if you go, say, if you're looking for getting married, say, in about 2 or 3 years, that's 2 or 3 years away. You know, that's not today. And you have to look at today as well as the future, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think back as we were getting ready for this interview and, you know, leaving college, I mean, the priorities weren't all those, you know, big focus things that are part of my daily life now.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing, like, just as simple as emergency fund. You know, having a savings account and dedicate to create a cushion, you know, for things that will come up. You know, we look at our budgets a different way, you know, once you get, you know, through into a lot of these responsibilities. And I think you do coming out of college and you realize, okay, here's my bills. This is all I'm ever going to have per month. And then, as you know, Chris, life happens, you know, and the bank of mom and dad will not be there forever, you know.
Well, and also think, too, that the coronavirus pandemic didn't help any either. It's made the fact that you needed an emergency fund, if you don't have one, you at least have to start putting something aside, even more important.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think it's even, if nothing else, you bring up a good point, the awareness around, you know, even job security is not what it used to be. You know, a lot of people make job changes, things that happen, you know, in the world, you know, not just the pandemic, you know, the job changes that occur are just part of the natural business life right now, and it's mm-hmm. something that you just got to be cognitive of.
Yeah, and debt is another problem that we all, regardless of whether we're just, you know, we're an adult or whether we know somebody we know has just graduated from high school, it's very important that you keep an eye on that.
Well, it's funny you mentioned it. I remember back to when I was in college, and I don't know what it is today, but I know when I roamed the campuses, you know, there was people standing on the corners ready to get your credit cards, you know, and give you applications. And, you know, when you're in college at that point, you're like, okay, I'll just, yeah, great, free money. Let's use the credit cards. And you come out of there, and before you realize it, you know, credit card debt can be crippling. And, you know, it just, yeah, I remember those days where it was rob Peter to pay Paul. And,
yeah.
And then, you know, in addition to that, you know, now I think more than ever, kids come out of school with a lot of student loan debt.
What do you think about too? There are opportunities now where you can qualify for relief, I guess, to deal with some of the issues, and in particular because of the pandemic. I know the CARES Act of 2020 is one of those.
Yeah, and you know, in connection with that, it's just, you know, what is your plan to pay it off? You know, because a lot of those minimum payments are structured where, you know, it resonates so much with me because leaving school, I remember I was on the 10-year repayment plan, you know, and 10 years is a lot of years when you talk about paying back college loans, and the debt is just huge. I think it's, you know, the statistics, so just over $1.7 trillion in college loans that are out there, and I think like over 42 million students borrow, you know, and carry federal student loan debt, yeah, you know, of an average of $36,000. I mean, think about that, Chris. $36,000 starting off in a new path where typically you start off a career and you're working your way up, and the income is barely enough to survive, in my opinion.
That's right. We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about looking for young people into the future, trying to plan for the future when it's not exactly in their sights right now. We talked earlier about budgets, and budgeting is very important, and you've got some tips on that too, I understand.
Yeah, I think this is really the critical part of it, because as you get out of college and you start getting, in my opinion, a little overwhelmed, right? And the priorities are, you know, pay this bill, pay this bill, pay this bill. And I always emphasize, you know, pay yourself first, because even a little bit goes a long way when you think about the time horizon. Like you said, hey, retirement's forever off in the future. But as you start creating that budget for savings, you know, budget for vacation, budget for the things that you know you want to do, so you have a little bit of, you know, play money and have some fun along the way. Because if you don't, you know, it's just going to be very, very difficult to stay with the budget if all you do is pay bills, because you do want to spend time and enjoy and do things along the way.
And I guess saving and investing are a couple points too that we probably have to look at as well too if you're wanting to allocate money.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest thing I always tell young people, even old people, whatever it is, if you're working and you have the opportunity, you know, where a company can offer some type of plan where it makes it easy, you know, automatic, where you can, you know, have a percentage. And if you do a percentage and do that automatic saving, you know, that percentage will increase the amount you're saving as your career moves on, as the income improves, and you help develop these long-lasting financial habits. And absolutely, if they're matching, do not give up that, as I call it, free money, right?
Yeah.
It's the best opportunity to get money working for you where it's doubled up coming right out of the gate, or if they're matching it at 50%. And, you know, if they don't have those plans, start one. You know, a Roth IRA is one of the best vehicles you can start as a young person, because usually you're not up against the income limits. You know, it's something easy to do even at a $50, $75, $100 a month. And to my opinion, the Roth IRA is one of the best vehicles you can use and instruments to provide value in all different types of scenarios.
Well, in thinking about all that as well, too, and if for anybody's lucky to get graduation presents and particularly money, it might, even though it seems painful to think about, it might be a good idea to put that in the bank or save it for a rainy day to be sure. And Greg, thank you very much for bringing up the advice, and we'll pass that along, of course. And that people who are listening and need some advice, they can always check with their own financial advisor and find out more. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The end of the school year is in sight, and we've all done our best, I guess, with the control measures in place to deal with the pandemic, and maybe there's some hope that the pandemic may be waning, but we still don't know about the effects of the past year on stress and change and uncertainty on the mental health of our young people. And that's why we turned to Dr. Tammy Silverman. She is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute to talk about it. Tammy, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Always my pleasure. Good to be with you, Chris.
Well, tell us first here about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have said about some of the issues with young people. Some of them are behavioral problems. Some of them are problems that have been happened in the past, but they're seemingly cropping up even more so in young people these days because of the pandemic.
Absolutely. And it's important for us to just kind of normalize the fact that mental health issues and disorders are common. You know, they're common in kids, they're common in adults. We need to destigmatize those things. So some of those behaviors, ADHD, anxiety, depression, those are the most common ones that are diagnosed in children. So you know, that was happening before the pandemic. However, the American Academy of Pediatrics is now letting us know that the stress, fear, grief, isolation, all that uncertainty is of am I going to get infected and what will my symptoms be, and all of those things is likely to have increased the number of kids that have at least one mental health disorder.
What mental health problems are we starting to see, at least, or we hear about happening that there will be some indication that we have to take care of matters right away because of the pandemic?
Sure. Well, that anxiety and depression, that you know, again, it's not uncommon, and we know that it happens. It's something, you know, broken ankle or diabetes or whatever those other health concerns may be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that those things need to be addressed. However, some of the ability and some of the stopgaps that we usually have to identify them, particularly teachers, educators, and counselors who are really good at noticing behavior changes in kids, that's been a lot harder because we've been virtual, right? Or
that's right.
They're not around them as much, even if you have a hybrid schedule, or they're not in after-school activities, so that coach may say, wait a second, I'm seeing some different behaviors in a kid that I'm a little concerned about that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Let's take this as far as age group is concerned. How about younger students? So what might we see that we should be aware of?
Right, and that's great. Thank you for asking, Chris, because the symptoms do show up differently depending on the age of the child. So for young students, that can be really intense worry or fear, and maybe they're talking about those fears a lot. It can be frequent outbursts. It can be my stomach hurts, my head hurts when there's no underlying medical cause. And it can be a lack of interest in playing with other kids. That's how it shows up in some of our young kids.
Okay. Now, how about adolescents? They're going to have some of the same symptoms, but maybe some different ones as well.
They do. And so for adolescents, symptoms can include a loss of interest in those things they used to like. If they were an avid soccer player or skateboarder or whatever that might be, now they don't want that suddenly anymore. They're sleeping too little or too much. And this age group may start to engage in some of that risky, self-destructive, self-harming behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big things here is that a sign of distress for this age group is spending a lot of time by themselves, social isolating. Now, that rings a bell with COVID, right, because that's something we've all had to do more than what we normally do. And that has made diagnosing and identifying mental distress all the harder given the pandemic.
Yeah, that's true, because if you're learning by way of virtually or some other remote method, you're not going to be able to see those. So these traits, certainly, they're not going to show up on the screen and in front of the teacher. Yeah. How about older teens and young adults?
You know, again, sometimes we think they're almost grown. They sometimes have big bodies, so that we think they're fully developed. But we need to figure out, you know, we need to keep in mind the fact that they may have lost a job. They may have, obviously, they haven't been able to interact with their peer groups, which is really important to this group. And their school may have closed, whether it's a college or a university or a trade school. All of those things have also added to their stress.
Now, how about teachers? We haven't mentioned the educators. They are not stress-free, to say the least, these days.
No, and I know they've done some fantastic, heroic work focusing on the kids, but we need to pay attention to them as well. And Education Weekly just had a report out that said that teachers' level of stress and anxiety, somewhat not surprisingly, have soared, while their morale and enthusiasm for their jobs has gone down. Mm-hmm. So that's not what we want, right? We need to have these great, caring teachers in the classrooms, you know, teaching our kids. So it's really incumbent on the districts to think about what they can do to support their educators while also addressing the needs of those kids, and that's a pretty tall order.
Do we forget about any pre-existing conditions that may make things worse?
Yes. You know, I think obviously we always need to look at particularly different groups of kids and teachers. We know that Black and Latinx students and teachers were more likely to have more COVID impact. And so we need to make sure that these historically marginalized groups receive additional services and that are matched to their individual needs. And we can't lose sight of those facts, and we want to make sure that everyone gets exactly the support that they need.
Okay, we've talked about a lot here today in our conversation. Are there any places that you can recommend that we can go to, take a look at, any guidebooks that are out there that we can refer to and get some help that way?
Absolutely. The American School Counselor Association has a great resource out there, as does the National Association of School Psychologists. Finally, I would just say the U.S. Department of Education also has a guidebook on helping school districts that includes educators and students and staff as they think about how do we support social and emotional well-being, mental health needs of our kids, particularly as we're looking at coming back in the fall.
We certainly know that mental health services are going to remain very, very important as the recovery from the pandemic continues on. And Tammy, thanks for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
Tammy Silverman's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.